to order the Veterans Division. And Representative Lesh, would you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have a motion to move the minutes? Yes. Motion that for the February 9th, 2015 minutes have been moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Welcome, everybody. We have a full slate of bills on the agenda today. We have five bills. If you take a look at your notes. We have House File 125, 312, 501, 406, and 260. And with that, we're going to have a change in the guard here while I present my two bills to the committee.
With that, let us proceed. Representative Detmer, would you care to introduce your House File 125?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I would like to move House File 125, the Veterans Job Tax Credit, and I would like to have it referred to the Tax Committee.
Very good. Proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House File 125 is very similar to House File 10 that Representative Wills brought before the committee and now sitting in the Tax Committee. And when I was taking a look at it, I just felt it's because it's being carried in the Senate also that I should go forward with this bill also. And basically provides the employers a non-refundable income tax credit for hiring a qualified veteran. The credit equals 10% of the wages paid to the veteran, and the maximum credit is $3,000 for a disabled veteran hired and $1,500 for an unemployed veteran hired, and also $500 for a 9/11 veteran hired. And that's the bill, and it's came forward last year. It made it through the committee process, and then I believe it was vetoed at that time in the governor's. So with that, we do have one person here that would like to testify.
Chair Denae, would you care to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ralph Denae. I'm chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council and a 30-year retired Marine. This bill, if you listen to the news media, they say that unemployment in Minnesota is really low. But if you look at the veteran side of the house, when it comes to those figures, it's much, much higher than what it is in the state for just the average person. Legislation like this, I believe, is needed to help open the door and to make employers realize that they can benefit from this as well as take care of our veterans that are returning from the Guard and from active duty. You know, the military is downsizing. That means we got a lot of qualified women and men that are coming back to Minnesota that need jobs. And I think this might be just one of the bills that would really help open the door to those veterans. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Detmer?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and we have one more testifier, Mr. Kaiser.
Yes, Vice Chair Kaiser, introduce yourself, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the Vice Chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, and I run a nonprofit organization that supports the honor flights here in Minnesota. this bill is really needed. Now, in the state, in the federal process, I just saw on the Veterans website that it just increased that to almost $8,000 for a hiring a disabled veteran in the federal for, I think, that's a disabled veteran. For a unemployed veteran, the number was like $3,000, and for just any veteran, it was less. This is a caveat to what we're trying to do here. The federals are doing this. They understand the problem with reintegration of men and women. It's really something that's neat. I think there's no way that it should not be passed this year. Minnesota is a starter of the yellow ribbon concept. We're trying to reintegration of the families and the veterans when they come back from deployment all around this world. Part of that yellow ribbon designation states that you're supposed to help facilitate hiring and getting veterans back into the workforce, and this would be exactly what we're talking about. The President of the United States makes this statement, the governor of the state of Minnesota, and all the governors of this fine country are all trying to do this thing. Just as one more thing that the state of Minnesota can do. Iowa does it, Wisconsin does it, North Dakota does it, so does South Dakota. How about Minnesota? Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would wish to testify on this bill? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you take a look, according to the December report of the Joint Economic Committee and the U.S. Congress, all veterans' employment rate in Minnesota is about 5% over in 2013. Over the same time, post-11 veterans, which this bill addresses, unemployment rate was 8.8%. For comparison, the overall unemployment rate in Minnesota in November in 2013 was 4.8%, which I believe it's lower now. This bipartisan bill will help incentivize hiring of veterans in Minnesota, especially those who have served post 9/11. So with that, I renew my motion to refer House File 125 to the Tax Committee.
Before we do that, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have one quick question. I'm not very familiar with tax law, and so I get confused in this stuff real quickly. What I wanted to know is, on terms of the tax credits, how would it apply toward nonprofits? I know there's a lot of nonprofits out there who would look at hiring folks back and forth. Is there a way that they'd be able to take advantage of that tax credit?
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I'm just assuming any employer would qualify for this benefit. That's my opinion. So it's not directly addressed in the bill.
Representative,
if I could do a follow-up question. Is it necessary that it needs to be, or does it qualify across? And I don't know who would have the expertise on that to be able to answer it. Because I definitely know the intent that Representative Detmeyer has, but it's something that sometimes, because of the way nonprofits do things that we think might automatically apply to them don't.
Is there somebody on staff here that could maybe answer that? It looks like we do. It's a good question.
I think we have the answer here. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nina Manzi. I work in the House Research Department. And the answer to the question is that because a nonprofit organization does not have tax liability, they would not be able to use this credit because they don't have any liability to offset with the credit.
Thank you.
Thank you. That clears me up, too.
Yes. Thank you for that help.
Representative Fisher, anything further?
Not that I can think right offhand. I'll probably talk offline with the author a little bit.
Very good.
Thanks.
Okay, we have renewed the motion to proceed to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
I do have a question or a comment.
Can we do that?
Representative Newton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand where you're going with this, Chair Detmer, but I would question why we are designating 9/11 veterans as a special category when already any unemployed veteran gets the $1,500, and an unemployed 9/11 veteran would get less than that. They'd get $500.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at just an unemployed veteran would be $1,500. A disabled veteran is $3,000, and then just another veteran coming in looking for a job is $500.
Representative Chair and Representative Detmer, does this mean as a qualified veteran they have to be unemployed according to this? In your section C, 2C, any unemployed veteran gets $1,500, but an unemployed 9/11 veteran would get a credit for the employer of $500. It just seems like it's less, but it doesn't serve any real purpose to have that category. And I understand, Representative Detmer, that you're trying to put some emphasis on 9/11 veterans who tend to be unemployed at a higher rate.
I think we're looking at on page 2 of the bill, page 2, Mr. Chair, line 2.21, for hiring a disabled veteran as qualified employee, the credit equals 10% of the wages paid, or it is not to exceed $3,000. And then 2.24, for hiring an unemployed veteran as qualified employee, the credit equals 10% of the wages, not to exceed $1,500. I see what you're saying now on 2.27, for hiring a 9/11 veteran as qualified employee, the credit equals 10% of pay, not to exceed $500. That's something I need to take a look at that language. I see your point. Yes. And what I'll do, I'll take a look at that before it, you know, for the next committee on taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's meet on that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Newton.
Okay. We can. You can do that prior to going to the
right.
Taxes. With that, the renewed motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Carried. We'll now proceed to House File 312. Representative Detmer, again, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, House File 312, I would request to move 312 and be referred to Committee on Taxes.
Very good. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, and committee members, 312, first of all, we have an amendment, a DE1 amendment, and I'd like to move the DE1 amendment. Basically, what the DE1 amendment will do, it will bring the bill in the order that I would like to have it for the tax committee. And basically what it does, it brings the bill so that it's identical to the House File 137 that we met here, that was heard here before, but it phases in. It phases in the taxable income deferment. So I would like to move the DE1 amendment.
Is there any discussion questions on the DE1 amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That's carried. To your bill, Representative Dutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, as we talked about House File 137, basically with this bill now, with the as amended, it will phase in what we talked about at House File 137. And as I mentioned before, that of the 50 states in the District of Columbia, 9 do not have general income tax. The remaining 42 states and 35 exempt at least a portion of the military retirement income, and 3 provide credits for retirement income. What this does, it phases, basically takes House File 137 and phases in over over a period of years, which make it more palatable when it comes to putting together the omnibus bill, the tax bill. So with that, you know, we can, I have Mr. Donais here as to do a little testifying.
Chair Donais, would you introduce yourself again for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Ralph Donais with the United Veterans Legislative Council, 30-year retired Marine. So this bill would definitely affect me, but I am one of 54% of the military retirees that live in Minnesota that's over age 65. That number has grown about 8% in the last 10 years of retired veterans that are over the age of 65. Last time I was here, Representative Newton asked how many generals and such we had in the state. I apologize, I don't have that here today. I was contacted by the DOD actuary. They are putting it together, and I should have it in the next day or so, sir, and I will get that information to you. But again, whatever we can do to bring the young men and women back to our state, I think we have a lot of great employers in the state. For those of you that haven't studied history a lot, I'm not a history buff, but I know that a lot of big companies were started by veterans in Minnesota. I believe 3M, Greyhound, a bunch of the businesses up in the Iron Range were all started by veterans that came back to our state. And I think we need that same workforce to start new businesses and new ideas in the state. And this is one way to say, we welcome you home. Come back to Minnesota. Thank you, sir, and thank you, committee members.
Thank you for your service and your testimony, Chair Donais. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. If you just take a look on page 4, it's pretty self-explanatory. Starting in line 4.25, for an individual who receives compensation for a pension and other retirement pay, the federal government for service in the military as computed under the United States Code 10, Title 10, and so on. The dollar amounts for each year, a portion of the year military up to a maximum of 20 years. And I say up to a maximum of 20 years because you have to have 20 years in to draw retirement in the military. And there are those that were retired during the Clinton years at 18 years or less. And also those that are medically retired. For the taxable years after December 31st, 2014, the specified dollar amount would be $500. And for the taxable years beginning December 31st, 2015, and before 2017, it would be $1,000. And then for the taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2016, the specified amount would be $1,500. So that's basically House File 137, as I mentioned before, it's phased in over those years.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House File 312? Representative Detmer, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, I renew my motion that House File 312 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Yes.
As amended?
As amended.
As amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Carries. I think we will have another changing of the chair here. Thank you.
Okay, next bill up is House File 501. Representative Fenton.
Well, first things first, because this is my first. So I have that treat for the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, does this bill go to taxes? I think it should.
Reverend Davis, I'm afraid it goes to GovOps. Yeah. Thank you, Reverend Fenton, for bringing those treats in, and make sure the word gets out to the other freshmen. And Reverend Fenton, do you want me to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do.
I will move your bill. House File 501 be referred to GovOps, Government Ops.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to give a little bit of feedback. I'm really passionate about House File 501. And first of all, the first time I ever met our Secretary of State was a few years ago when we were working on a bipartisan effort for election changes and reforms. So I'm really honored to be sitting here today presenting my very first bill with him sitting by my side. So thank you very much. What House File 501 does, it does a couple of things. It's expanding the military voting procedures to State Guard service. So basically what we're doing is this would expand the definition of military to include National Guard activated for state service. And this would make the definition of military consistent with the definition in other areas of Minnesota law. As well, this bill is about enfranchising children of overseas Minnesota voters. And this is another reason I'm passionate about this. One, my father was former military, but my family were expats living overseas. So basically, currently children born of Minnesota parents living abroad are unable to vote if the children have never lived in the U.S., but when they become adults. And so this would allow that to happen. Currently, 30 other states allow these U.S. citizens to vote from their state if that state is the state in which their parents last live. And this is a federal ballot only. And the last thing it does is it updates the language, and it updates the U.S. code cross-reference to the correct cross-reference. So with that, I would like to turn it over to our Secretary of State, Secretary Simon.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Simon, welcome to our committee. You're not a freshman, okay, but we'll use these cookies to represent you too. First time,
right.
First time in front of our committee, and again, congratulations, and I know you're going to do a great job in your assignment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be before you, and I've really enjoyed over the years working with you in particular, Mr. Chair. We've served on committees together, and I really appreciate the opportunity today. I want to thank all members, most of them former colleagues here in the House, and it's great to be with you as well. And I want to especially thank Representative Fenton. As she said, it was several years ago that she and I and a small group worked together on an ultimately successful bipartisan piece of legislation, which I think really changed Minnesota's election system for the good. And so it was a pleasure to work with her then and now. She's been a really passionate advocate, as you can see, for this particular issue. House File 501, or the sum and substance of it, came to us through the Department of Defense. Which recognized that in Minnesota, for some reason, and we're not the only state to do this, there is a divide between the treatment of those called to service by a governor versus those called to service in the National Guard by a president. And it seemed to us, Representative Fenton and me and our office and certainly the Pentagon, that if someone puts on the uniform of this country, the sort of voter protections and accommodations they get should not depend on whether a governor called them up or a president called them up. Some interesting facts, I think, are that we have, and many of you know this, by virtue of your own backgrounds and interests, that we have about 13,000 members of the National Guard of Minnesota. And interestingly, even though we rank 21st in the nation in population as a state, we are 6th in the nation in terms of our contingent of National Guard members. One other interesting statistic is that since 2005, there have been over 22,000 person days, that is to say one person per day who's called to active duty, 22,000 person days worth of time spent by National Guard members called to service by governors. Usually it's in the case of, usually but not always, obviously, it's in the case of various natural disasters, fires, floods, blizzards, tornadoes, sometimes missing person searches, but the point is their service is no less worthy of recognition and accommodation. Some people have asked, you know, what kind of accommodations are we talking about? This sort of split that occurs between someone called up as a, by a president versus someone called up by a governor. Well, they are things like, you know, we enable and entitle people in the National Guard right now who are called up for federal service to get their ballots in some circumstances by email. They can't send them back necessarily by email, but they can get them by email wherever they are, often in far-flung places. Or, for example, members of the National Guard who are called up on federal service don't need a witness for their absentee ballot like the rest of us do, the rest of us civilians do. That's an accommodation, or those kinds of accommodations, I think, are important and should not depend on who called them up to service. So simply put, I hope that this is more of a consensus issue. Representative Fenton has certainly been dogged and passionate about this, and that's the sum and substance of the bill. So I'm eager, ready to stand for questions, but we're proud to lend our support in the Office of Secretary of State to this measure.
Representative Lesh,
you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Steinman, welcome to the committee. The cookies were delicious, by the way. Thank you for that. Secretary Steinman, Representative Fenton brought up in her introductions the provision for the expat provision, whereby these kids are allowed to vote but only federally. How does that work? Are you in charge of making sure they only get the federal portion of the ballot that gets sent out? Are there two separate ballots? How does that work?
Mr.
Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh. Yeah, there's something called the federal-only ballot. That's administered jointly through the Department of Defense and the state of Minnesota. So these folks, in this instance, let's say there's someone who is born to parents who are in the military or in the Foreign Service. You know, Representative, former Representative Marion Green is one of those people. Those who served with her, remember, she grew up in a Foreign Service family. So those folks who have lived overseas and maybe never lived in Minnesota, they and their families are paying taxes. And when it comes time to vote, they're sometimes stateless and they're homeless. And so this enables people to vote on a federal-only ballot. So they're not voting for city council. They're not voting for state legislature either, for state house or for state senate, only in the federal races.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh?
No.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Any other questions? We have more testifiers?
Yes, we do.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and other distinguished representatives. My name is Robert Chaussier. I am a Minnesota resident, and I just completed 32 years of military service. I have the, I guess, experience of having served in the National Guard, Army Reserve, and active duty, and I have voted multiple times abroad throughout the world. And I fully support this bill because I believe that my National Guard colleagues should have the ability to vote for their state legislators and other people on the ballot. That's it.
Well, thank you for your service. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines?
Army.
Go Army. Okay. Any other testifiers? Anyone from the public would like to testify? Well, with that, I would renew my motion that House File 501 be referred to Government Operations. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you,
members. Representative Driscoll, House File 406.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 406 before the committee
and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Judiciary.
Rep. Driscoll has, moves this bill, House File 406, to Public Safety. Okay, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the bill that's before us is not a new bill. It's a bill that I've been working on and others before me, Representative Detmer and others. And what this bill does is it puts a $100,000 each fiscal year of 2016 and 2017 into the public safety budget for the purpose of increasing training of public law enforcement as other and other public safety officials to engage in de-escalation training. Many law enforcement officers and first responders are trained in a number of different tactics in a number of different areas and situations that they're presented with. One that is very crucial and timely is that of dealing in de-escalation with veterans in situations that law enforcement or other public safety officials may come involved with. One of the things that we do know is that most veterans come back from service and do fine with reintegration. Some have a little bumpier ride back into to civilian life than others. And this de-escalation training is designed to be able to help law enforcement and other public officials or public safety officers when they encounter an individual who is having a difficult time and has military connections, to be able to help understand the needs of that veteran and to be able to address those needs in a way that they might not have otherwise been trained to do so. Last year, we were very fortunate to be able to bring this bill through government, state government finance and veterans affairs and bring it to public safety, but for various reasons, budgetary primarily, in an off-budget year, it was not included in the supplemental budget bill. Since we're at the beginning of a new biennium, it's my hope that we are able to include the funds for such training. It's also important for folks to recall and to remember the members of the military are trained with in a number of weapons as well as a number of tactics. And so a law enforcement officer, particularly one who is unaware that they're going to be visiting with a veteran, could put themselves and others in harm's way depending upon how they respond to that situation. And I have a couple of thank yous that I'd like to make before I introduce testifiers today. I'd like to thank Representatives Purcell, Detmer, and Newton for co-authoring this bill with me. They have been stalwart co-authors on this, and I'm also pleased to announce that it's a bipartisan effort in the House, and it's also a bipartisan effort in the Senate to be able to bring this about. The testifiers that I have today, one is Mike Mills from Central Minnesota. He is involved in our Central Minnesota Warrior to Citizen and Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Initiative, which myself and Representative Howe and Representative Tice are very actively involved with in Central Minnesota. As a matter of fact, we have some other members from our group who are today joining us as well who have an interest in advancing veterans' issues. We'll also be joined by John Baker and Mr. Bill Miklas, who also have worked in this endeavor in the past as well. And so with that, Mr. Chair, with your blessings, I'd like to have the committee hear from Mike Mills.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Mills. Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Mills. With this bill, with the de-escalation, it would help a lot with the veteran suicide rate or suicide by assistance with de-escalation, because it would, when we hit our breaking point, we're not in our right mind, and no one for the law enforcement and public safety to know how to do how to help us de-escalate would be awesome.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mills.
And, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mills has been actively involved in our armed services and has nobly served our country and continues to work with veterans in his current employment through Independent Lifestyles, which is an initiative statewide that helps veterans, among others, be able to live, as the name says, in an independent lifestyle. I'm just really happy that he was able to be here today with us, along with the other members from Central Minnesota, to be able to talk about this very important initiative. And I oftentimes will bring back to our local committee, we meet on a monthly basis, updates of what we're doing here at the legislature and bringing ideas that they have forward as well. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to have Mr. Baker and Mr. Miklas come to the testifying table as well.
Okay. Representative Driscoll, welcome to the committee. Would introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is John Baker. As the chair knows, I've been in front of this committee many times over the past few years. I'm retired from the United States Marine Corps. 22 years in the Marine Corps. I'm a local attorney, and I concentrate my practice on representing veterans and service members throughout the state of Minnesota. As many members, as the chair knows, I chaired the initiative to start veteran courts in Minnesota here in 2009. We've made some great strides. When I was doing that work, I knew that law enforcement, you know, we've done a lot of work with veterans in our criminal justice system, but I knew that law enforcement was the first contact many times that veterans and crisis have, and we didn't have any training. And I became affiliated through my work with veteran courts. I became affiliated with the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, and about 4 or 5 years ago, we got funding from the DOJ, federal funding, and we developed a curriculum for de-escalation training for veterans in crisis that we go around nationally. Matter of fact, Mr. Miklas and I are going to St. Louis next week and teach St. Louis area law enforcement de-escalation tactics, ironically, and it happens to be for law enforcement. But one of the, as the chair knows, this bill originally came through in 2013, the last biennium, and we developed a curriculum with the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute was awarded the contract by the Post Board, and we developed this curriculum that we have been going around the state. One of the other handouts that all the members have is this map of where we have gone around the state and have done the training. What we're able to do with our state programming is we took what we were doing at the national level and we made it even better here in the state of Minnesota. And since we've got the original funding, and I'll let Mr. Miklas talk about the numbers, but we've gone around the state. But the other unique thing about the training that we've done is not only the curriculum, but it's the team that we have training. So it's the course that we've developed is a full-day course for law enforcement. It's law enforcement receives post-accreditation for it. They have to get a certain amount of post-board accreditation each year, and this makes them eligible for that. But it's Mr. Miklas and I that teach the course. Mr. Miklas is a retired law enforcement officer, knows the police tactics. I'm retired military. I know what it's like to deploy and come back home. And I'm also an attorney that represents a lot of veterans that have been in crisis and have been through this. So it's a very powerful team that we've been able to go around the state and teach this course. And I think the proof is that we haven't had any suicide by cop in the state of Minnesota in a long time, thankfully, and hopefully we aren't going to have that again. But as Representative Driscoll said earlier, you know, cops don't want to take on combat-trained veterans in combat tactics. What we teach them is you have to de-escalate a situation to an environment that favors law enforcement, and that's what we do with our training. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr.
And welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, again, good afternoon and committee members. My name is William Miklas. I'm a retired police officer in the city of Burnsville. I have a background in police tactics, SWAT team tactics, and negotiations as well. I've been the associate director of the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute now and associated with them for about 14 years. When it's possible to defuse a situation without using physical force, all parties benefit. The veterans, family, the officer, the department, and the communities they serve. If public safety personnel can recognize the various reintegration problems leading to behavior disorders, they can be better equipped to protect themselves and those involved. The focus of our program here is to support returning veterans by training public safety professionals on unique needs of the post-deployment military personnel, as well as protecting the families and their communities. John Baker made mention of the map. I'll just talk a little bit about statistics here. Since our original funding, UMCPI has completed 24 training classes to public safety personnel around the state.
reaching approximately 725 participants. We have remaining 10 classes either scheduled or in the process of being scheduled. It's been our experience that in order to have the most impact on police practices and behavior, we need to reach a tipping point of approximately 25% of the police population. Police, and I'll open it up again to public safety population. As you know, there are approximately 10,500 licensed peace officers in the state. Our goal is to reach approximately 2,500 of those license holders. This bill will provide funding to reach that goal. One of the biggest contributions to the success of the program has been providing de-escalation strategies to more effectively manage crisis situations, and then providing a next step. What will the first responders do with those individuals? And we provide an opportunity to meet and refer to local resources. We have county veteran service officers attend and make presentations at each of our courses. The purpose of this proposal is to request funding for at least 24 trainings per year over the next 2 years. The training will be geographically distributed over the state of Minnesota, consistent with the chiefs and Minnesota sheriff's regional districts. UMCPI will provide all administrative support for this initiative, including grant reporting and student manuals, covering all aspects of the training, resource material, and addressing services that are available to the veterans and their families. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And maybe one of the testifiers or Representative O'Driscoll could answer this question. How is the current courses, how are they funded, how are they currently funded?
They're funded.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I believe your question, how are the current courses funded?
That's right.
And it's initially from the first legislation that you sponsored, Mr. Chair, in 2013. And I believe that was initial funding of $100,000, and that's what we've been with right now. That was the initial funding. Representative O'Driscoll asked for $50,000 additional last year. That did not go through, so we're asking for this additional funding. Okay. I believe the original, your original request, Mr. Chair, was for $200,000.
That's correct.
We got half of that.
Okay.
And I think with the original amount, we could have hit the tipping point. So that's why we're back asking for the money to get us to the tipping point of 25% of licensed peace officers in the state of Minnesota.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This bill does ask for $200,000, and with the work of Mr. Baker and Mr. Miklas, we probably are going to see some retirements in law enforcement. We're going to see some attrition and things. And so to be able to put this last effort out there, we may end up having trained more than 2,500 people by the time that we're done. But as far as active law enforcement officers, the peak and the goal is 25% or 2,500 members of law enforcement throughout the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Is there anybody in the public would like to testify? And okay. Yes, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know whether it's Gunny Baker or Representative Driscoll, but how often do you plan on going back to do the retraining? That's the first part. The second part is this enough money to do what you would like to do in terms of the de-escalation training?
Mr. Chair, if I might start, and then we'll refer to Mr. Baker.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, to your question, there's two things. There's one is the initial training before retraining, so we want to hit that first mark. And secondly, it doesn't specify that it has to be for initial training, so there could be monies that could be allocated in this, or funds that have been allocated for this purpose could be used to backfill for retraining or for bridging the gap in training on this. As it relates to the schedule and how that's going to work, I would refer to Mr. Baker for that conversation.
Mr. Baker?
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, and thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Newton. It would be really nice that we didn't have any future wars, that we'd have to do more retraining, but that's just not the reality. And we know that with our returning veterans, I will tell you, Representative Newton, that, you know, when I started veteran courts, I was asked, who were going to be the veterans that were going to be showing up in veteran courts. And I said it's going to be Vietnam vets that are going to be showing up there. And we're seeing Vietnam vets that are still articulating through the criminal justice system today. You know, the way we initially did this, Mr. Chair and Representative Newton, is provide this initial training. And we're hoping with this next bit of funding that we can provide some of the retraining. But we haven't even hit the tipping point yet, Representative Newton, that we can hit a mass amount of the law enforcement in the state of Minnesota where we can look at retraining yet.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gunny, when I look at this, you know, I'm from Coon Rapids, Blaine area, two significant towns. Are they the police forces in those communities being included with the other police force, for example, Maple Grove, when you do the training to make sure that we, is it sort of a regional thing that you're doing, or are you trying to get to each department? Thank you.
Mr. Baker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, I'll defer to Mr. Nicholas, but I will tell you, with the federal training that we're going to do next week, we're going to St. Louis. We have about 15 law enforcement officers coming from Philadelphia for that training. So we just did a training in Woodbury a couple weeks ago. We had at least 25 Minneapolis Police Department there. So when we do training in an area, Representative, we advertise this for anybody that can come in, Sheriff's Department, dispatchers, folks that are working in the jails, everybody that can come in, and we get them coming from all over the place. And a lot of that, Representative Newton, is on the dynamic of the schedules of law enforcement, because we can't go to one department and have their entire department there for the entire day. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Mr. Baker, is there any, or Representative O'Driscoll, is there any fee involved for the departments?
Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Baker speak to his training. And again, there's a broad umbrella that's on here. The funds are going to the Post Board, to the Peace Officer Standard Training Board, and they will make determinations within their curriculum how to spend money for new law enforcement, and they will then authorize funds to go to groups like are represented here today by Mr. Baker and Mr. Nicholas. Mm-hmm. But I will let Mr. Nicholas or Mr. Baker speak specifically to their to the administration of their plans and programs.
I would defer to Mr. Chair and Mr. Nicholas.
Okay, Mr. Nicholas, yes.
Yes, there is. There's a $15 fee, and that it covers a lunch that the students pay for on their own. We deliver the lunch, and we have a working lunch where the representatives from the local resources come and speak during our lunch break.
Okay, thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the question that Representative Newton asked about retraining possibilities and how long it's going to go on. This could be a while, and I mean, we've got vets coming back now that are, you know, 20s and 30s, and I just want to, right after Representative Driscoll come over to my office. I don't remember where we met on this, but it, in the hallway or whatever, and if I want to be on this bill, and I said, yeah, you bet. And within 24 hours of that, I was made aware, I mean, this was, you know, a month ago or more, and made aware of that a Vietnam vet was executed in Georgia. And you all may know something about this incident. It was a dash cam video of it. I asked my LA, I said, she said to her, I said, I'm on a sign on this bill, or get me on this bill, or something like that. Well, there was this incident in Georgia, and I said, well, I wonder what that's about. There's always wonder what's going on with a vet. We all know somebody, or more than one somebody. Well, if anybody wants to see that video, I made the mistake of watching it, and it kind of haunted me, because both police officer and the veteran should be alive, but the police officer didn't know how to get out of it, and the veteran did, and he killed that police officer. And I was just quite taken by this whole scenario then, and the thing that haunts me about it is this veteran in that video that shot that cop looked almost spitting image of a good friend of mine, Vietnam vet, that passed a couple of years ago. It just blew me away. And so I'm saying this because this is not, until we get rid of war, this is going to need to go on and on, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your initiation of this legislation. Thank you for carrying it on. But we're going to have to figure out how to keep it going here, because we're going to need funding every couple of years. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. And any other questions? Any other questions? And Mr. Baker, I know I just last week I got an email from a legislator down in Iowa. You're talking about your veterans courts. This is something that Iowa is looking into. And if I can find that email, I'll forward it to you, because they wanted some point of contact. And I put them in contact with Washington County. They have a veterans court. And also, is it Ramsey County, Mr. Baker?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is Ramsey County. And Pete Orpett, who is a Marine Corps veteran and the Washington County attorney, started that program. I helped him start that. We have all of our major communities in the urban area have veteran courts, and we have in our rural areas, it's a little bit, because of the different scales of our courts, it's a little bit more tougher to do it, but we've developed models for our greater Minnesota as well. So I think we've been on the cutting edge of veteran courts in the country, Mr. Chair, and we've been on the cutting edge through your initial legislation and Representative Driscoll's continued legislation. Nobody else is doing this around the country, Mr. Chair. Right. We are leading the nation on this type of stuff. And as the representative said, with that Vietnam vet down in Georgia, this is what we teach. We teach law enforcement how not to get in a situation like that, and it's been very effective. And we've got a lot of law enforcement that is a lot less, just like our legislature at the state and national level, a lot less of veterans working these jobs. So there's a lot less familiarity with it. But I will tell you, Representative, that as we talk to law enforcement, they get how similar that they are to the veterans. There's not a single cop that I have worked with that wants a situation that's going to get out of hand.
And maybe just to piggyback onto that, committee members, I know that this type of training is going to help law enforcement, not just how to deal with our de-escalation program for veterans, but any type of person that they come in contact with. It's going to be carry over in that types of situations also. So with that, Representative O'Driscoll, would you renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I might just make a few final comments.
Right. I'm sorry.
No, and I will be brief. I'm oftentimes asked, well, how are you going to be able to determine whether this money was well spent as taxpayer dollars? I simply say this. If it doesn't leave the news, if it's not above the fold, and you don't hear about it on the radio, it's doing its job.
That's right.
Plain and simple. Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 406 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Judiciary.
Well, committee members, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion for House File 406 to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee members, next bill is House File 260. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd ask that House File 260 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. I know, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh, I just was informed that Representative Cornish would like to see your bill.
I bet he would, Mr. Chair.
So would you like to refrain your request?
Yes, I'd ask that it be recommended to pass and be referred to Representative Cornish's
Public Safety
Party Committee, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Representative Lesh has requested that House File 260 be referred to Public Safety.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I do have an AA-15 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. I would move that amendment.
Okay, Reverend Lesh, the AA-15 amendment, please talk about your amendment.
Sure, Mr. Chair. This is the Scherer amendment. I have next to me Staff Sergeant Scherer, who serves in my battalion, 2 of the 135 Light Infantry Battalion. And it's an effort that Sergeant Scherer, back when he was an E4, I think, or P5? He was an E5 back then. Newly minted E5 on the Kuwait deployment, Mr. Chair, in attempting to get some of his visitation issues resolved. When House File 260 was shown me by Representative Scott, Mr. Chair, I saw it as a perfect opportunity to finally resolve this long-standing issue that Sergeant Scherer faced, which is attempting to get some semblance of a reasonable visitation with his children while he was deployed. And because there was no framework for that, it was a quandary in his situation, but also that of many other situations. So I'd ask member support.
Okay, any questions on the amendment, on the A15, I'm sorry? All in favor of the A13 amendment?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, Representative Lesh, go on with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill as amended, House File 260 as amended, Mr. Chair, is the Uniform Deployed Parents Custody and Visitation Act, and I would note a few things about this. It would ensure that military parents are not penalized for their service while still giving adequate considerations to the interests of the other parents involved, as well as the best interests of the children, of course. Minnesota is the only state in the union that does not have this specific framework. And in light of that, I'd note three things. Number one, this is a uniform law, members. So those of you that are familiar with uniform laws, it's one of those laws developed by the Uniform Law Commission, and usually they're not terribly controversial because they've had the edges sanded off by a working group. To that, as well, Mr. Chair, it's a product of a working group of the military and family law sections of the Minnesota Bar Association, who have worked exhaustively on this to make sure that it's compatible with Minnesota law and also that everyone's happy with it. And then finally, I would note, Mr. Chair, that these are provisions that judges can already do. So we're not setting up anything that it was impossible for judges to do before. But the family law judges, as are many judges in Minnesota, are very hesitant to start down a path of a novel approach without having some framework in place. And that's what this law does. It sets in place a framework. So with that, if I could, Mr. Chair, I hand it over to Sergeant Scherer, who can speak to you about his personal situation wanting this.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Sergeant Scherer. Could you introduce yourself?
My name is Samuel Scherer. I am a 10-year member of the Army National Guard for Minnesota. And I was asked to come present myself with you guys today and share a story, so I thank you guys for taking the time to listen. And I'll try to make it brief, as I did write just over 2 pages, but I'll kind of cut that down because I know your guys' time is important. Like Representative Lesh had said, this was an idea that came about while I was deployed on our deployment in Kuwait in 2011-2012. The reason it came about to me for a virtual visitation was because I was married previously, and on my first deployment, my wife left me. We had a child, and I was not allowed to see my child. It was very, very difficult for me to have any visitation whatsoever. When I came home on leave in 2008, I was held to guidelines that are written in this state that aren't even statutes, to time that should be potentially allowed to a person who has gone distances away from their children. The first day was a half an hour of supervised visitation. The second day was 1 hour of supervised visitation. The third day was allowed to be 8 hours of unsupervised visitation for me to see my child. So in a total of a 10-day period, I was only able to see my child less than 12 hours. I had bought webcams, equipment to be able to see my daughter while I was overseas. That was met with resistance. For the duration of that first deployment, I no longer was able to have any contact whatsoever. I received two pictures, one from Christmas and one from her first birthday. Returning home in 2008, I was met with resistance of being able to see my child, as it was deemed kind of unbeneficial to be able to see her because of the period that I was gone, that it would cause shock to my daughter of me being away for so long. That wasn't until August of 2008 when a judge immediately overturned the decision and allowed visitations to take place right away. But it was left in the hands of a guardian ad litem who didn't take much into consideration. I had to work over 40 hours a week while going to school at night for over 25 hours a week just to be able to support myself and my daughter. So my time was very restricted. Having a virtual visitation could be a huge benefit while being deployed as well being stateside. In 2011, when we geared up for our deployment, just prior to that, I notified my ex-wife that I would be deploying at a certain time, a certain date, which was unknown. I asked that things become a little more civil and that she become a little more lenient on allowing my family to be able to spend time with our child so that I, in turn, could be able to see her through the time that I'd be gone. That never happened. As I turned into the training portion of our deployment, my family had to wait over 8 weeks for the convenience of the time to be allowed for my family to see my daughter. During the time that I was deployed, it wasn't until I came home on leave that I was able to see her, which I was able to have a little more time than I did on my previous deployment, but had only been able to see her twice while I was deployed for the entire duration of my 9 months in country and 3 months in training. Representative Lesh became well aware of my situation as I started a petition while I was overseas. It was in regards to the name of Operation Virtual Visitation. I started it on change.org. I presented my story to people and received over 400, just under 500 signatures on the petition. I also started a Facebook page in connection with it to gain more support, where I had just over 1,000 followers. That didn't lead to any more signatures on my petition, but it was just another chance at making it aware to people that there needs to be some sort of a change. In 2012, when I returned, it seemed like it was a continuous uphill battle. My ex-wife and their family offered me $10,000 to walk away from my daughter's life. I turned that down immediately, and it became a very big struggle. My daughter was instructed not to tell me she loved me. My daughter was instructed not to hug me. My daughter was just instructed to just not even consider me as her father, as my ex-wife was preparing to remarry. This led to a very difficult time at the relationship that I was having with my now ex-fiance. A lot of issues that arose were because of the situation of me trying to gain parenting time. I put way too much effort and time into it, where it really dissolved everything in my life. When my daughter began to show that she had no interest in me, it led me on a path that I'm not proud to say that I was on, because as a veteran, when people kill themselves, they automatically refer to it as a PTSD issue that they had because of things that they've seen in the service. Well, that's not always the case. Because when I realized my daughter had no more interest in me, I realized that I should have no interest in myself. And I began drinking a lot, and I contemplated suicide many times. It wasn't until I actually sat down with my daughter and began doing a one-on-one conversation as to see where exactly she's coming from, and informing her that I too grew up in a lifestyle like that, where one parent doesn't like the other parent and uses words to turn the person away. And through these discussions, my daughter's grown closer to me. Through the time that I'm able to spend with my daughter, which is still very limited because I have to work over 60 hours a week to maintain my life and my children's lives, I only get to see my daughter now every other weekend, so I've cut over 4 to 6 days out of an entire month from seeing my child. Having virtual visitation would ensure that there's communication through phone, through email, texting, now that there's children probably as young as 8 years old who know how to do that. And my daughter is 8, and she has an iPhone 6, and she has an iPad, which is beyond me, but she has that, and she has the capabilities. But my phone numbers have been thrown to the side, stating that if your father wants to speak to you, you had an entire weekend to talk with him, you're on my time now. Having a virtual visitation would become very beneficial to people who are in my situation, not necessarily just men, but women, because there's women who serve who don't have full custody of their children. It is an opportunity to bring into a bigger picture of other household people who aren't just veterans, but just everyday citizens who have to work long hours away from where their children reside and are in similar situations from a divorce where it's hard for them to maintain contact. So it would be a great thing for the state, great thing for the people, great thing for the parents who are in these situations for something like this to start rolling and open up the door for new ideas. So I appreciate your time, and I am willing to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And we know that whenever there's a deployment in a family situation, it always puts a lot of pressure not only on the husband, the wife, but also the children. And we know when there's a separation taking place in the family, there's even more pressure put on our children. Do we have any more testifying?
Yes, we do, Mr. Okay. Chair. If we could, I have with me behind me Lindsay Olson with the Department of Military Affairs and Jill Clyburn with the Minnesota State Bar Association Military and Veteran Affairs Section. Both of these women have worked many hours in trying to craft this as a reasonable resolution to the problem just presented by Sergeant Scherer as well as others in the state. So if we could have them forward.
Yes, come forward. Ms. Olson? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lindsay Olson. I'm a major in the Minnesota National Guard, and I'm the general counsel for the Minnesota National Guard. I'm here as the MSBA chair of the Military and Veterans section as well. And this is Ms. Joanna Clyburn. Mr. Chair,
Ms. Clyburn.
Members, I'm Joanna Clyburn. I'm a practicing family attorney that specializes in military family law. When I'm not practicing family law, I'm also a colonel for 27 years in the Minnesota National Guard. So I've seen both aspects of this legislation that's before you. Representative Lesch is correct. There is no legislation in Minnesota that provides these protections as there are in other states in the United States. And I want to give you two prime examples of the situations that we've seen. First off, I had a service member who had sole custody of his child. The mother was estranged, had 4 various relationships in the last year, domestic violence, moving from home to home. The service member had remarried, had 2 stepchildren. The new stepmother was very involved in the child's life, everything from parent-teacher conferences to sporting events to picking out the dresses for school. When the service member received notice of deployment, the former spouse stepped forward and said, "I want all the parenting time." And despite the fact that there were step-siblings and a step-parent involved, it was very active. The court struggled to provide any contact with the previous family members, with the new family members, simply because the rights of the former parents, or the current parents, excuse me, the biological parents. We know from studies that stability for children and the ability to maintain routines is extremely important for them adapting through military deployments. In that particular situation, the judge made some decisions that, frankly, I'm not so sure that would have entirely flown had it been appealed. The judge did the right thing, but in that particular case, I don't know that they really had the legal framework to stand on. Another case, when I was serving in, when I serve in my role as commander, one of the things a brigade commander does is they interview the soldiers leaving their formation. And I had a young soldier who was a superstar, what we would call on track, commissioning, potential the opportunity for a $25,000 reenlistment bonus, and I asked why he wasn't reenlisting. And he said that he'd had four children and that he had shared joint custody with his former spouse. And as a result of deployment, he went from having 1 week on, 1 week off, to seeing his children every other weekend, and that was it, because military service was seen as incompatible with the stability of children. I stand here before you to tell you that there is an issue that needs to be addressed. We've worked with the family law bar. We have worked with the Veterans Committee to develop this based off of the Uniform Law Commission. I see this as a good opportunity for Minnesota to ensure that wearing one's uniform does not mean an automatic loss of your children, but that we focus on what is the needs and the best interest of the child. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. members of the committee, I've worked on this legislation with the Uniform Laws Commission. I was on the drafting committee as a military expert, and I worked with the Minnesota Bar on this as well, and have run the legal assistance office for the Minnesota Guard for several years before becoming the general counsel. And I've seen literally thousands of these cases, as Sergeant Scheer and Colonel Clyburn described. And Minnesota is currently the only state in the nation that does not have some type of protections in this area. And I believe that's something that we really need to remedy. We also need to remind ourselves that often we talk about service members' rights here, and this isn't really about that. It's about the children in these families. And as Sergeant Scheer showed you in his story, what affects the parents affects the children, that instability that's created. This law really goes to that, as Colonel Clyburn said. And so we're not here just advocating for service members, but for families. We'll open it up to questions.
Well, thank you. And just a comment, you know, during my 20-month deployment during Iraqi Freedom, being a senior warrant, many times I spent time talking to young soldiers, young married soldiers that had young children back at home, and this is a subject that was brought up along with our chaplains, who was very busy with this very issue. So I think it's, from my experience, I think it's something that many Minnesota should probably really be looking at now. So any questions? Senator O'Driscoll, Mr. O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, if I'm not mistaken, you and Representative Scott have teamed up on other joint and shared custody legislation in the past, and I encourage you to continue to do that. It's clear today that that's needed, and it's only being complicated by deployments that people don't always get to pick when those things are going to happen that can divide families. And so I will be supporting your bill today and encourage you and Representative Scott to continue to work on other joint custody issues that are outside of the purview of military to help families and those kids be able to have access to both parents on an equal basis.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Driscoll. I can't share credit with Representative Scott on this. Representative Scott has done yeoman's work for years on this. I'll be honest, I shy away from family law bills because precisely it's so gut-wrenching. I went through my own divorce 10 years ago now, and I was extremely lucky to have a really good relationship with my ex-wife, to the extent that, I mean, we still communicate daily, and I consider her a close friend. But I know that I'm very lucky. And I think about, while I haven't been deployed like Sergeant Scheer, I think about being down at basic training at Fort Benning, and these young bucks half my age come in wide-eyed, and after a month they start getting these letters from their girlfriends or their wives that things aren't looking too good at home. And I remember the sounds of them sobbing themselves to sleep at night in their racks. I really, it's difficult for me to do this because of those stories. But I just wanted to say I'd have to give more credit to Representative Scott on that, although I will absolutely continue to work with her on it.
Yeah, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, Major Lindsay, maybe you can answer this, but the language in this, is this the uniform language? Is the same language that the other states have? And specifically, I'm concerned about the term deployment. And why would we limit deployment only to unaccompanied tours? And why also would it implies that it's an overseas deployment of some sort? Why wouldn't it be any assignment that's away from the home for a period of time?
Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton. The reason that it focuses on deployment of unaccompanied tour is because this looks at times when the parent is going to be gone for an extended period of time and unable to work within the current custody situation that is occurring normally. So this is addressing the point at which there would be an absence of that parent for an extended period of time.
Representative Newton?
Mr. Chair, I'm still a little confused because someone could be assigned to, say, a three-year tour somewhere going to Europe or Japan, and they'd still be away from their family. So I don't understand why the fact that it's an accompanied or an unaccompanied tour, if the former partner or spouse and child are not going with the deployed person.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The reason for that is because the courts then can craft a parenting remedy for the parties. But what often happens is during a deployment, the access to the child or to the significant contacts within that child's life, say step-siblings or step-parents, are not as readily available. And so things like not being able to communicate with the child through electronic means or mail or being able to arrange regular parenting time, the parent, if it were, basically is giving their derivative parenting rights to someone who is within that supportive nexus of that child, if it is within that child's best interest. It is not meant to replace the service member in any shape of means. It's meant for a short-term duration during this deployment where the operational tempo is such that that service member cannot be with his or her child. And so for the stability of the child, we're looking at providing another means of ensuring that parenting. Additionally, what this legislation would do is it does amend the best interest factors to specifically account for the fact that the court cannot use solely the sole purpose of military service in determining the best interest of the child, and that they have to look at the remaining 13 factors in determining parenting schedules and continued contact. What we don't want to have is the ability for folks who would not normally have standing in a family law case to step forward into the court situation and basically convolute the parent-child relationship, but rather for the short term that the service member is being deployed, if the circumstances warrant the best interest of the child, that service member could provide derivative rights, their derivative rights, to this other parent while they are gone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I more or less get that, Colonel. I'm just, the fact still remains that if someone is a career military person and they're assigned on a long-term, on a tour, which would normally be an accompanied tour, they're still going to fulfill the requirements of the accompanied portion of the tour, whether they have family with them or not. And they're still separated from their child, even though they're going to be able to get their 30 days leave a year. But I'll leave that portion. The other, I think, has to do with legalese. And I know you're all attorney up there. But in Section 6, it mentions multiple times in a record the other parent. You have to notify in the record the other parent. Who's right? Is that the court record that you have to have it done in a court? For a layperson, is a little confusing.
Representative Olson or Claiborne?
Mr. Chair, Representative. That just means that it has to be in some type of written form and submittable. There has to be a record of it, some proof.
And Mr. Chair and Major Lindsay, does that mean it has to be documented? Like you have to have a registered letter to prove that you notified the other parent? Is that the understanding of that?
Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't have to be a registered letter. I mean, that's one way to give that proof. It is not that specifically required. The language is intended to say there has to be a way to prove that you have given that notice in some manner, whether it's a registered mail or hand delivery with a signature of that individual, like when you're served, in a lawsuit.
Representative Newton?
Having been served many times, I understand.
Mr. Diebel, you have some comments on this issue, on the House research?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Newton, that provision on deployment and the use of that term caught my eye as well when I was looking at this. One piece of the definition I think may assuage some of your concerns that it does address mobilizations as well as deployment. In the terms of military parlance, I think of deployment going to a war zone as opposed to mobilization. If I'm sent to Fort McCoy, am I allowed to avail myself of the privileges in this bill? And it caught my eye because I had a colleague who was sent to mobilize to Fort McCoy, and she attempted to live in La Crosse and bring her child with her. And the court did not allow that, even though it was an unaccompanied tour, she had the right to pay on her own. So I think one of the questions that may need to be addressed is, are typical orders for mobilizations unaccompanied? And if they are, would give them the protection, because the document says they're unaccompanied, even though they could pay for the family to come with them.
Mr. Newton?
I think it's a little vague, and I don't know whether the service members would know, or if the order issuing authority would understand that as well, when the term of deployment and accompanied or unaccompanied tour. If you're mobilized and you're sent from here to Fort Knox, Kentucky, you're still deployed. In the general sense of the word. But for the military, recently at least, we use deployment only if you're going to a war zone. But for example, what happens if you go to Azerbaijan in support of the war in Afghanistan? You're still deployed, you're not in a war zone, and yet you're in direct support in a whether it's an accompanied or unaccompanied area. I think those questions really should be addressed as this moves on, and I don't know if it's going to be addressed in the next committee, but maybe the committee after that.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
We've already, excuse me, this bill is already on the Senate floor right now, and we've already changed it with this amendment whereby they'll accept our language or we'll have to conferee it. But in any case, I'm open to having a conversation with Representative Newton about those possibilities to assuage his concerns, but maybe even make it a little bit better. Because I agree with his point on that. At the same time, we want to make sure that this gets through. So if it pleases the chair, I'll work with Representative Newton between now and Judiciary Public Safety.
Okay, that'll be fine. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Anyone from the public would like to testify? If not, Representative Lash, would you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 260, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to Public Safety Committee. But, Mr. Chair, I would note that when you stated the amendment, I believe you said the A13 amendment. Mm-hmm. Are we clear on the record, Mr. Diebel, that we're good with the right amendment number so that this bill is properly amended?
It should be the A15.
A15 amendment.
Or it was announced the A13.
Mm-hmm. So I think I said A13, then I said A15 after that.
We're good. Okay.
For the record.
For the record, it's the A15 amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then that would be my motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If the author could restate his motion or correct his motion. You can't say pass. If we say pass, then I'll get sued again.
So it's just refer? Is that okay? Mr. Chair, I ask that House File 260 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Representative Lesh,
as amended, Ms. Chair.
As amended, has requested that House File 260 as amended be referred to the Public Safety Committee. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Pass. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.